So we have Bill Fox. Bill Fox, please get yourself ready. Bill Fox. You're going to come down.
This
here.
Is your life.
Our next one is Mary Page Michelle or Michael. Mary Page Michael. Joey Nichols. Is that correct?
Your email is jsnichols@gmail. That's more legible than your name.
All right.
I had just finished saying to my wife in the audience, there's no way they're going to pick my name because there's a million people who've filed a claim to come up here, and then my name was called. So I am Bill Fox, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. I hope everybody's having a great time because I am. I've got a story that's a little bit serious, and it involves getting you all, because I know you will, be thinking about your beliefs in a supreme being, i.e. God, when I finish the story, which I'll tell very quickly because it's kind of long, but I'll abbreviate it. I'm the father of four daughters. All of my daughters, yes, thank you very much. When you're the father of four daughters, you learn two very important things. Number one, put the toilet seat down. And number two, you learn the true meaning of PMS, which is pop must suffer. Be that as it may, my women, including my wife, have taken very good care of me for many, many years. So back to the story. The bottom line of it is I'm the father of four daughters, three of which had children. One daughter did not. And the daughter who did not wanted nothing more in this life than to become a mother. And her husband wanted nothing more in this life to become a father. And the problem wasn't getting pregnant. The problem was keeping the pregnancy. They had been pregnant numerous times and had miscarriages many times, all the way up to a baby that was 1 week from the delivery date and died in utero, which was very sad. Anyway, after a period of a number of years, 5-6 years of marriage, they were in a position finally of going to have a child. And our family is Jewish, and my daughter and son-in-law are very observant Jews. They chose an observant Jewish obstetrician to deliver the baby. It's a custom in the Jewish religion amongst the observant that the name of a newborn or soon to be newborn is not divulged to anyone until the child is born or until after they're born, they're officially named, I should say. So I know that the two of them were wrestling with the name of what this new baby was going to be. They knew it was a girl. They had narrowed it down to two names, and they could not make a decision until the actual day of delivery. They had not made a decision. They're in the delivery room. My daughter, of course, is there with her husband, and the baby is being born. And as the baby is being born, the obstetrician says, so that everyone in the room could hear it, and there were a number of nurses, and of course, my son-in-law, Rachel, that's a good name. It turns out that that was the name that they had chosen. And out of the blue, the doctor made that statement. My daughter looked at my son-in-law with daggers and said quietly with her eyes, "Did you tell him the name?" And he looked at her and said, "I didn't tell him the name. Did you tell him the name?" Neither of them had said a word. The baby was born. And after the baby was born, the two of them spoke to the obstetrician in the delivery room and said, "Dr. So-and-so, how did you know the baby's name?" And the doctor said, "I didn't know the baby's name. But doctor, you said when the baby was being born, Rachel, that's a good name." The doctor said, "No, I didn't." He has no recollection of saying that. Yet they confirmed with the nurses that were in the room that they had heard it too. Now, was that a message from a higher authority? Think about it. I don't know. That's my story. Thank you very much.
This seemed like a good idea in the back row back there. My name is Mary Paige Michael, and I want to tell you a story about the beginning of my married life. So I started dating my now husband. I told you the end before I told you this. Back in 1982, we were in high school, and we made it all the way through college. 1991, we decided to get married. So I told my husband, the only thing you're responsible for is the limo and the wherever we're going to go on our honeymoon. That's all you have to do, the limo and the honeymoon. So my mother is an incredible rock star. She's a planner extraordinaire. So we really worked on this wedding down to the details. We were both the first married on both sides. We were both athletes in college. We had a big group of friends. We're both from Baltimore, so it was a big wedding, 4th of July weekend, 1991. I mean, the bridesmaids were red, white, and blue, and we had an ice cream cake. And, I mean, it was, my parents surprised us with fireworks. I mean, it was extraordinary wedding. So at the end of the night, I had hired one of those things that you'd find down at the harbor where you pedal on the little machine. And so my brother-in-law was pedaling us away. And at the end of the night, it was fabulous. It was just a fantastic night. And my now husband turns to me and he says, "You know, I got the greatest deal on this limo. I thought it was going to be so expensive, but, you know, it was a great deal." So we're pedaling. It was in North Baltimore. We're pedaling down the road. We come up to the limo. It's a hearse limo. So they had packed us a picnic from the dinner, you know, from the wedding, because you never eat at your own wedding. And we sat in the last row of the hearse limo. And we drove down to Dulles, because we were flying out of Dulles to go down to the Caribbean. And we get down to Dulles, and we can see our hotel, but we can't get there. We're driving around exit, and we're doing this. And the limo driver, the hearse driver, turns to me, and he says, "I'm sorry, I don't usually go to hotels."
Hi, everyone. My name is Joey Nichols, and I'm a doctor, which is probably why my handwriting is illegible. I wasn't always a doctor, though. I didn't start out that way. I've only been a doctor for a few years, but I wanted to tell you a story about how I became one. It's interesting, because when you're a doctor, especially a family doctor like me, every person who comes to see you brings with them a story, many stories, and you become the keeper of these stories, and I'm not going to share with you any of those stories today, because they don't belong to me. They belong to other people. But I'll share with you a story that actually does belong to me. It's my own story. When you're becoming a doctor, it's a little bit difficult. You spend most of your life in school. If you're lucky, you're done with all that school part by the time you're 30, and then a third of your life is gone, and you're just kind of standing around wondering, okay, well, the next third, I'm going to work, you know, even harder than I worked to get here, and then, you know, maybe at the end of it, there'll be some retirement kind of thing, and then what will I do if I'm lucky to have the final third of my life, right? But here I was standing near the end of the first third of my life with MD behind my name and a couple of other letters that aren't really relevant. And thinking, you know, I'm responsible for all these people's lives and people bring me their stories and I really try to take care of them. I work really hard. You know that there are 168 hours a week. When you spend 80 of them in a hospital, you become acutely aware of the fact that there's only like 68 left to, you know, 86 left to go. And a number of those you're going to have to be sleeping, ideally. and doing a number of other things if you're lucky. So it came to pass that in the winter of my first year of residencies, which you do after you finish medical school, when you're really supposed to be becoming a doctor, I wasn't really feeling like a doctor yet. My grandmother had been increasingly ill, and we didn't really know it at the time. I just got married right before residency started, and there's these lovely pictures of my grandmother just glowing like, oh my God, like her favorite grandson, the doctor, he's getting married to another doctor. My wife has a PhD. I call her the real doctor because she actually had to, you know, like write a dissertation, have original thoughts to become a doctor instead of just memorizing a lot of stuff. Man, there are a lot of PhDs in this room. So, you know, and Grammy looked great, right? In all the photos, she's just mugging. She lost 50 pounds. And little we did know that the reason she lost the 50 pounds, it was cancer. And so, you know, and I still remember sitting at the restaurant with my wife. We got to go out to eat maybe once or twice, like a month that I wasn't working. And we actually had a Friday evening out. And so I get a phone call from my mom. You know, Grammy's dying. She's got ovarian cancer, they think it is. She has all this fluid in her belly. And I don't remember, honestly, a lot from medical school. If it doesn't come in the form of a rhyme or a dirty joke, it pretty much fell out of my brain. And the rest of it, I have to look it up, you know, as I'm going along. But I do remember that if you've got, like, fluid in your belly and ovarian cancer, that's a really bad thing. That's probably, like, stage 4 ovarian cancer. People don't get better from that. And you know, she was a very thoughtful woman, and she'd lived a long life, and she'd raised her 5 children and had a number of grandchildren, and one was a doctor. So, you know, you can't do much better than that, really. And so she had thought, like, she'd never wanted to, if it came down to it and the Lord was coming knocking, you know, she was going to answer the door and go quietly. And so, unfortunately, you know, all of the doctors down in the part of Texas where she lived, it's a little scary what happens down there where I was born. So they did a surgery, they opened her up, and they did one of these things where they kind of look around a little bit, and they're like, yeah, we'll just close you back up again. Unfortunately, in the recovery room, the PACU, after she had her anesthesia, was supposed to be waking up. She had probably a little blood clot that went into a particular part of her lung that made her stop breathing, and she should have died. But nobody bothered to notice the fact that she had a DNR order, do not resuscitate, so they went ahead and resuscitated her. And I get a phone call at work when I'm in the middle of seeing, like, a full schedule of patients. Yeah, so your grandmother died, but they brought her back. And a weird thing happened. I was actually really angry. Because I worked so hard every day to understand my patients' wishes and to respect them, and the fact that somebody had disrespected my grandmother in that way, she just really wanted to be, to be done, do you know what I mean? But somebody had violated her and brought her back to life. And that's weird to think about it, like someone can insult you while bringing you back to life simultaneously. That doesn't happen in a lot of places. But it's a thing that happened to her. So I looked around for something to throw, which when you're in a medical office is a scary proposition because there's lots of, like, sharp surgical instruments and things if you really went looking. So, look, fortunately, I found, like a ball of yarn, and I threw it against the wall, and it was, like, the most unimpressive display of anger imaginable. So I flew out to Texas the next day and signed my grandmother up for hospice. And we took her home, and of course the story goes on. I don't have time. The bell rang, but I mean, I could tell you the story about my prodigal uncle, the prodigal son returning, you know, from the biker gang that robs, you know, trains of, like, military weapons, and how he tried to, you know, get his share of the family inheritance and stuff, and how we had to cut him out of it. That's a whole other story, but I never really felt like a doctor until I got to fly home to Texas and sort of take care of my grandmother and protect her from all these other doctors who were trying to do helpful things, like the day that we brought her home from the hospital, you know, her bedpan was full of blood. And it was the bright idea of her family doctor. Oh, why don't we get GI on board? Because she's a train, you know, sort of rolling down the track toward death. And the more people we have on board, I guess the more interesting the train ride is. I don't really know, but ultimately, she decided she wanted to go home and to die comfortably, surrounded by her family members and her loved ones. And that was a gift that I was able to give her. And nothing I've ever done as a physician, and probably nothing I will ever do as a physician, was more important to me than the ability to do that for her. Because if I can't do that for her, this woman who's been so important to me and who I've loved so greatly in my life, then, you know, what's the sense of doing it for anybody else? So I want to thank you for the opportunity to share that story.